Issues Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Now, if you appreciate Issues Etc., please consider making a tax-deductible gift today. You can make a secure online contribution at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. You ever wonder where that term came from, Islamophobia? It makes me a little nervous to hear the term because it's one of those things. It's like homophobia. It gets thrown around. If you have any concerns about an issue, suddenly you're phobic. You're afraid or you're trying to monger fear or something along those lines. Where did it come from? How is it used? And should we be concerned about Islam and its aims, both theologically and politically? This, of course, on the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan for Muslims, a month that, well, needs a little explanation, especially when it's falling here at the very beginning of the summer. We're going to be talking about those two issues on this Tuesday afternoon, February the 7th. Dr. Alvin Schmidt joins us. He's Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College, author of the book The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me again.
This term Islamophobia, you're the sociologist. Where did this term come from?
Well, it's not all that old. It came from England, actually, about 20 years ago in the 1990s. A fellow by the name of Trevor Phillips, who was head of the United Kingdom's Commission on Racial Equality, coined that particular term. Interestingly, only 2 months ago, in April, he has repented, if I may say, for you having introduced that term. He has retracted, giving after he has found recent studies, for example, in England that indicate that the phobia, as he defined it, was supposedly an unfounded fear, is not really unfounded, given that Muslims, for example, are not interested in integrating into the British society, which he and so many others assumed and still believe today, that they want to have a separate country within a country. And so he has retracted it. And it's also interesting when he coined that particular term, as you and I know, half of that word, the latter half of it, phobia, comes from a Greek word meaning fear. And the Greek word fear means simply that. But now with his having made it a word together with Islam, it was conveying an unfounded fear, an imagined fear, a prejudicial fear. And that's what the term Islamophobia basically means, that you, anyone who doesn't agree with Islam's religion is an Islamophobe, someone who fears Islam. Well, it became a politically correct term. The media have latched onto it and are probably never going to let it go. In fact, it's interesting that even Phillips in England is receiving criticism for his recent switch on the matter. But that's basically where it comes from, and that's its meaning. So if you and I don't agree with Islam and critique certain aspects of Islam, and there are many that we can critique, we're an Islamophobe.
It's come to be just basically a cudgel that people use in public discourse to silence any kind of concern or criticism.
That's right. It's a put-down label, as I would say, very, very much. And the average person will basically succumb to it and be intimidated by it and therefore follows the agenda of those people who perpetuate that fear, that term rather, and at the same time, sort of with the left hand, they're protecting and promoting the various aspects of Islam.
If you're going to be looking at this issue as a sociologist, how would you describe not the unfounded fear, which this term has come to sadly describe, but the genuine fear that reasonable people, if not fear or concerns or however you want to put it, reasonable people have about Islam and its aims?
Well, that's just part of that's really what that term does. It basically, it removes any legitimate criticism of Islam because the moment they are cited, you are an Islamophobe. And so the moment that term and labels apply to you, the people who have heard what you said will discredit what you say. So it basically helps advance the agenda of Islam, ISIS, and all the other groups that you find, for example, in Islamic world today that are fighting Western culture, Christianity, and so on down the line.
What is there to be concerned about when it comes to Islam?
There's plenty to be concerned about. For example, I just noticed a couple of days ago in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, a rather lengthy piece written by a Muslim woman about how Muslim women have all the equality of women, for example, in Western society. Well, good grief. Again, this can only be accepted if you have not even read the Quran. And that, of course, has a lot to do with people falling for this propaganda that's put forth. For example, the Quran says a woman's testimony in court is only half of what a man's testimony is in the second chapter or surah of the Quran. A Muslim woman may only inherit half of what a man may inherit financially out of the fourth chapter of the Quran. A Muslim woman must ask her husband if she may go to the mosque. And yet, this article is printed, again, because the newspaper doesn't want to be Islamophobic, prints an article that is absolutely false. It doesn't fit the Quran. It doesn't fit facts. So the moment, what shall I say? It covers all the lies, and I will be blunt about it, lies that this woman, for example, put into the paper at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Yet many people undoubtedly will fall for it, because many of us in the Western society tend to interpret Islam in the light of Christian experience. For example, we see a mosque, and we immediately think a mosque is confined to having religious services only, because that's what the Christian churches do, that's what the synagogues do. Whoa, they don't know what Muslims do in mosques. A mosque is more a political institution than it is a religious institution. And there again, you see the ignorance on our part, conveyed by those who are afraid of being Islamophobes, perpetuates this false impression and basically means that we do not protect ourselves. In other words, you might say that if people seriously buy the Islamophobia argument, in other words, that we have an unfounded fear, we are slowly committing a masochistic suicide. We are inflicting a kind of a self-hatred upon ourselves. And this, again, advances the Islamic agenda.
When you say that people look at a mosque in the same kind of in the same framework that they view a Christian church, that kind of has to do with Islam as a whole, too. They tend to think of Islam as merely religious or spiritual ideas, therefore somewhat innocuous or set aside from kind of any political ideas. Is it right to understand Islam in a broader way than simply a religion?
Well, yes. One can argue, can make a very good argument, that Islam is primarily political and not primarily religious. But you see, our Western assumption again that it's primarily religious, and of course, that's what Islam promoters are saying, so that they know if they can promote that message, they will have a lot less resistance from us. If the term political were attached, they know it would obviously not be very easy for them to make us be silent and accept their presence in our midst.
This explains a lot. I mean, for the person who's hearing this for the first time, Dr. Schmidt, this explains a lot about why radical Islam or Islam in the political majority behaves the way it does.
Yes, it does. For example, it's an excellent example. There is a concept it's out of the Quran called taqiyya. Taqiyya is, to put it in Western terms, basically the old Jesuit philosophy of the end justifying the means. Taqiyya says that you can, to please Allah, lie to advance an Islamic agenda. And this is, again, part of taquilla. It's a very broadly applied and used concept. Whenever you can deceive the enemy, and the enemy, of course, are the infidels, namely you and I and all the Christians, Jews, etc., anyone who does not follow Islamic philosophy, religion, if you want, is of that particular persuasion. And so you have to persuade these people, deceive these people, so they will buy, again, their particular, I keep saying agenda or program, or their particular argument.
Let's talk a bit about Ramadan, which, as far as I understand, began on the 5th of June and will end 1 month later on the 5th of July. How would you introduce us to this month?
Yeah, well, Ramadan is another one of these holidays that Muhammad sort of preempted from the Jews, etc., back in his day. And it's supposed to consist of 1 month, 30 days, and of course, it never occurs the same month each year, because the Islamic calendar is 11 days shorter than our solar calendar. It's based on the lunar calendar. So it only consists of 354 days, whereas ours consists of 365 days a year. And so each day, or each year, there is a shift in, for example, of when the Ramadan will take place. For example, last year, in 2015, it occurred or began on June 18. This year, as you just mentioned, it began, for example, basically on June 6. There's sometimes depends a little different with part of the country, part of the world you are, and so. Again, that's because of 11 days. So you moved back 11 days. Now, 2017, it'll be about May 27. And so every year it's different. And eventually, in I think it's, 17, 18 years, it comes back to where it was at that time. So it takes about 17, 18 years to come back to the months that it, well, months of what we have today, June 6th, it'll take 17, 18 years to come back to that particular date again. But otherwise, in between those days, they're always at a different time.
What is being observed during the month of Ramadan?
Well, it's supposed to be a 30 days of fasting. And of course, that's a rather interesting concept of fasting. It's supposed to fast from sunrise to sunset. You're not supposed to eat anything and not technically supposed to drink anything, although that doesn't always happen. And then when the sun sets, the fast is essentially over until it rises again. And people will celebrate, they will eat, they will sometimes excessively eat and drink. So it's I call it a partial fast because it only takes in part of the day. And of course, in the wintertime, the difference between sunset and sunrise are, of course, not the same span as they are in the summertime. So that varies. But that's basically it. It's supposed to fast for 30 days, and you're supposed to, during that time, improve yourself in terms of being a better Muslim. You're supposed to read the Quran. You're supposed to memorize the Quran more if you haven't already. All these basic practices is to reinforce what you know about Islam and build on it as well.
It's a fast observed only during daylight hours, and then the evening is the opposite of fasting. Is that kind of
exactly
the way
true? Right, but most people don't know that. But that's very much what is the case. So it's between, well, after the sun sets and the evening gets dark, you can then go ahead and forget that you were fasting. But during the moment, next morning when the sun rises, the fast begins again. And this goes on for 30 days every Ramadan month. And by the way, Ramadan month is the ninth month in the Islamic calendar out of 12.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. We're talking about two issues, Islamophobia, and we're talking about the beginning of Ramadan began on Sunday. We'll talk more with him on the other side of the break. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. In Hour 2 of Issues Etc., Deaconess Rose Adel is going to join us. The recent Washington Post column titled 10 Unholy Reasons I Take My Toddlers to Church. We'll talk about children in church in Hour 2 of Issues, Etc.
Even if your child has mild to moderate autism, learning disabilities, attention difficulties, or other learning challenges, he can receive a classical Christian education. The Simply Classical curriculum was created by Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope, an author, educator with a master's degree in special education, and homeschooling mother of twins with special needs. The Simply Classical curriculum has become an answer to prayer for parents and schools. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 with the coupon code LPR.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod celebrates and affirms life from the time of conception until natural death and every time in between. For this reason, LCMS Life Ministry is a program singularly devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in our church body and the culture at large. Life Ministry provides educational materials, hosts conferences, and works closely with allies such as Lutherans for Life. For more information, visit lcms.org/life and follow LCMS Life Ministry on Facebook.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Christ Lutheran, Jackson, Mississippi. Prince of Peace Lutheran, San Diego, California. Trinity Lutheran, Tryon, North Carolina. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Dallas, Texas, Calvary Lutheran, Yuma, Arizona, St. Paul Lutheran, Milford Center, Ohio, Peace Lutheran, Chehalis, Washington, Christ Lutheran, Noblesville, Indiana, Our Redeemer Lutheran, Lexington, Kentucky, and St. James Lutheran, Baltimore, Maryland. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. We're talking about Ramadan. He's Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College and author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. You can find out more about this book under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. What is the function of fasting then? I mean, Ramadan in general, but fasting as one of the, I believe it's one of the pillars of five pillars of Islam. What's its function?
It is.
I know what the function of fasting in Christianity is. It's generally either a sign of repentance or it's a kind of a discipline for self-mortification, reminder of repentance, things like that. What role does it play in Islam?
Well, basically, as I indicated in part before, it is supposed to basically enhance, improve the Islamic person's commitment to Islam, make him a better Muslim. Hence, he's supposed to read the Quran, memorize the Quran. He's supposed to do all the different things that are expected of him. And, you know, interesting, you mentioned this in your comment, the word repentance. That is not part of Islam. The word repentance is not part of Islamic theology or ideology. That's a Christian concept. Again, we may, because of Christians having fasted, you know, we know that Jesus fasted, for example. People fasted in the Old Testament, and many Christians did in the Christian era. And when they did, for example, apart from Jesus, they frequently did it in part repenting and try to improve their sinful life, which, of course, didn't apply to Jesus, but it did apply to the people who did. But that's a foreign concept to Islam. Repentance would mean like that you've done some wrong and you need to ask God, in this case Allah, for forgiveness. But that's totally foreign. It's one of the big differences, again, between what you read in the Bible and what you read in the Quran is the lack of repentance. It is simply not there. And again, we need to remember that. And for me to say this, of course, makes me again an Islamophobe. But it's true. You don't find it in the Islamic religion or in the Islamic Quran. You don't find it in the sayings of Muhammad, traditions of Muhammad. You don't find it there. And so basically, again, it's to enhance and improve your Islamic posture. I might also mention one other thing that takes us back a little in our conversation, back to the Islamophobia thing. When, for example, people who are advancing the Islamophobia idea, they're basically committing a dhimmi posture. Dhimmi, D-H-I-M-M-I, is a posture that Muslims will have exerted wherever they are a majority. The non-Muslims have to pay a jizya, a tax, in order for Muslims not to attack them. Now, and again, basically when the Islamophobia ideology is advanced today, they're saying don't criticize them because they're going to attack us again. Well, this is such a specious argument that it leaves you almost breathless. What would we have said, for example, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor? Well, don't criticize them. They may bomb us again. This is exactly what's going on today. Don't criticize. We may get another 9/11 example. Or what would we have said, for example, in the latter 1930s? Don't criticize the Nazis because it may make them more angry. That's what the people who promote Islamophobia are promoting today. They call it, for example, an autoimmune disease in connection with ISIS. And this is ultimately, as I said a little while ago, a philosophy that is masochistic on our part and only helps them advance their evil designs.
You mentioned their ISIS, and do we see part of that, perhaps it's inadvertent, it's difficult to tell, do we see part of that kind of playing along with their ideas when U.S. officials will refuse to draw a line between or connect the dots between ISIS terrorism, both against Muslims and non-Muslims, and Islam itself?
Right. You know, the person, for example, people who criticize Phillips, who has now retracted his having introduced Islamophobia, basically say that our Islamophobic comments that we make only energize the individuals to become more Islamic. Well, for example, they're not energized by our comments. They're energized because of what they read in the Quran. You see, the basic problem lies that Western people do not read the Quran. As I often tell people in my different speaking engagements and so on, please read the Quran. You don't have to take my word. And here are some passages you want to look at. But people don't. And that is the problem. They know, I think the people who are promoting Islam know very well when they're giving out a Quran that people won't read it. And for two reasons. People, even as Christians, they're very poor Bible readers. You and I know that. But in addition to that, if you take the Quran and want to read it, it's a very difficult, cumbersome book to read. There is no translation that's very readable. And so I think for them to hand out a Quran is basically to many ways deceive us. That here is a book, you can read it, and you'll find out it's harmless. Well, if they really read it, they would find out it's not harmless. Because, as I have mentioned also in other contexts, that the violent passages in the Quran are all in the present tense. The violent passages, let's say, for example, in the book of Joshua in the Old Testament, are all in the past tense. They convey history. They don't advocate present indicative action to take place. And those violent passages in the Quran number about 100. And some of them are clearer than others, but they're all there. And so for us to draw attention to them is not being Islamophobic. It's simply pointing to the fact, holding the Quran at its own words, and reminding people we're not making this stuff up. It's right there in their own holy book.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He's author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Again, you'll find a link to it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Schmidt, thank you very much for being our guest.
My pleasure. Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to be talking in hour two with Deaconess Rose Adel. There's a recent Washington Post column titled 10 Unholy Reasons I Take My Toddlers to Church. Here are just a few. Sometimes I need a break. For me, there's coffee. For them, there's snacks. It's free socialization for the kids. Adult music is nice. Ladies love the kids. Kids take a good nap during church. There's no judgment. And I've made friends. We're going to be talking about some of those. Do kids belong in church? I think this was written at least slightly tongue-in-cheek by a churchgoer. Does it reflect the reason people take their kids to church? Essentially, it's free daycare for an hour or two on a weekend morning, and the adults get to go do adult things. Sadly, a lot of Christian churches are doing exactly the same thing, shuffling the kids off to children's church. We'll talk about all of that with Deaconess Rose Adel right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hi, this is Pastor Clayton from Zion Lutheran Church of Muscoota, Illinois, a proud supporter of Issues Etc. Zion is a congregation firmly grounded in God's grace given in the Word and Sacraments, where we treasure the timeless beauty of the liturgy. Zion is also a vibrant, young, family-friendly congregation where you would be warmly welcomed. Zion is located at 101 South Railway Street in Muscoota, Illinois, and we would love to share God's gifts of grace with you. For more information, please visit our website at zionmuscoota.com.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/Luther Academy.